he was a goner, but the cat came back. He just wouldn't stay away.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. In the animated The Cat Came Back, the cat in question is slowly destroying a sofa. Maybe you're familiar with the story. Sure, it's just a sofa, but some researchers are concerned that cats could pose much greater health threats than previously understood. The cat population has climbed steadily in recent decades, and now an estimated 85 million cats are owned as pets in the U.S., with another 50 million strays, many feral cats, roaming the streets around us. And with cats come cat feces, about 1.5 million metric tons of waste each year. Joining us to talk about how that poses a public health problem is Dr. Fuller Torrey, a psychiatric research scientist who specializes in schizophrenia and bipolar disorder at the Stanley Medical Research Center, where he is executive director. Dr. Torrey joins us by phone from Maryland. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. Nice to be with you.
So what does your psychiatric research have to do with cat feces?
Well, we have been looking at infectious agents now for about 30 years as a possible cause of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and there are several leads that have become very interesting. The most interesting lead is a parasite called Toxoplasma gondii, which is carried by cats and excreted by cats in their feces at the point where they're infectious on it. And although we have not proven anything, there's other studies that have also linked the possible relationship with Toxoplasma gondii to other diseases, including bipolar disorder, including brain tumors. And so we're going back and really asking the question, is there more danger from Toxoplasma than we thought in the past? In the past, what we have thought and what we know is that if pregnant women become infected with Toxoplasma, it can affect the fetus. And that's why women who are pregnant are told and have been told for now half a century not to change the cat litter.
Mm-hmm.
But we're raising the question of maybe there are other things that we ought to be looking at as well.
Could whatever is in the feces be transmitted to somebody without ever someone coming in contact with the cat litter per se, or whatever's left in the sandbox as it was? I mean, we've heard of that phrase, cat scratch fever. I mean, is there some way a cat could transmit the same thing without necessarily living with one?
Yes, but it's not like cat scratch fever, which is caused by another infectious agent.
Okay.
That you only get when the cat actually scratches you.
Okay.
This you would not get when the cat scratches you, as a matter of fact. This parasite is excreted by the cat over a period of about 2 weeks when it's infectious, and it excretes millions of these oocysts, which is the form of the parasite, on it, wherever it goes to the bathroom, which means your garden, which means your sandbox, which means the children's play area, which means the litter box, wherever it goes to the bathroom. That is where you could become infected. You could become infected if you, for example, were a six-year-old child and you were playing in the sandbox and you put your finger in your mouth. You could become infected. You can also breathe in the oocysts. After about 24 hours in your litter box, they can become aerosolized. In other words, they can rise up into the air with a breeze. So it is known that people can become infected also just by breathing in the cysts. Obviously, if you have a child, you may not have a cat at all. But if the child is playing in a sandbox that's been infected with a cat, and most sandboxes that are not covered are infected, then the child could also become infected at that time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Dr. Fuller Torrey. He's a psychiatric research scientist. We're talking about the diseases that cats can spread, and including Toxoplasma gondii. And are the oocysts part of the Toxoplasma gondii?
Yeah, it's a form of the parasite.
Okay.
The parasite is kind of a third cousin of the malaria parasite, and most of these parasites have very complicated life cycles and several different forms that they go through. And the oocyst just happens to be the form that the cat, when it's infected, excretes. These are microscopic cysts, so you cannot see them, but there are literally millions of them. And one of the reasons why my colleague and I wrote the study is because it's now apparent that we don't know how long these oocysts survive.
Mm-hmm.
The studies have shown they survive for at least a year and a half. They may survive for several years. So if you have cats that are going to the bathroom regularly on a sandbox or play area or wherever, you could have an enormous accumulation of these oocysts, and it only takes one to infect a mammal and presumably infect a human.
Are most cats infected with these already? I mean, do the oocysts hurt the cats, or do they just carry them?
The cat. It's a good question, Anne. The cat has been family with this oocyst, with this parasite, for probably several million years. So in most cases, the cat does not get sick, and it has no effect on the cat. Sometimes overwhelming infections will affect the cat, but that's the exception. Usually the cat is carrying it. The cat gets infected usually when it's a young cat, when it's going out to hunt for the first time and becomes infected. But you don't know that the cat's infected.
And so if you get a cat from a reputable cat breeder, for instance, and keep the cat indoors, you have a pretty good chance of keeping it away from, assuming there's not already oocysts in your house, keeping it away from this parasite.
That's correct. And if you have an indoor cat and it's always an indoor cat, you really don't have any worries. You know, theoretically, it could get infected from a mouse or rat that was in the house, but that's pretty unusual. So what we generally say is indoor cats are safe. Cats are nice pets. Mm-hmm. It's the outdoor cats that you have to worry about. And the number of feral cats in particular tends to be very, very high infected rate.
And feral cat populations growing exponentially.
We have no idea. People say anywhere from 15 to 60 million feral cats. I don't know of any good number on it. Altogether, though, now we do know that there are well over a million cats in the United States. Well over 100 million cats in the United States, and there may be 150 million. So cats are very common, and this is relatively new. We've had cats for many years, but not in these numbers.
If you adopt a cat, which is going on a lot, and people are encouraged to do that because there's so many cats out there, if you adopt a cat, can you get your cat tested for this?
I think you can. I'm not sure how expensive it is.
Mm-hmm.
You could take blood from the cat and check for antibodies, and if they have antibodies, then they've already been infected. So the answer to the question is yes, you could do that.
Okay, so are there different kinds of oocysts that act differently in the body, one giving a person arthritis, another schizophrenia, for instance, or are they pretty much,
We don't know. First of all, we don't know for sure that these are causing these diseases. This is part of our research that we're looking at. And I would emphasize that this is all still preliminary.
Mm-hmm.
What we do know is that there are different strains of the Toxoplasma gondii. One strain, for example, if you affect mice, it will kill most of the mice, but some of the other strains will not. So it may not only be a question of becoming infected with the parasite, it may be the strain of the parasite that you're infected with.
So with so many cats around, shouldn't we be sicker? If right now you're looking at correlations, right, not causations?
That's correct.
So is there any kind of correlation in the larger population that suggests, you know, any that we should be sicker?
There's no correlation. There is a correlation of by country where people tend to eat undercooked meat, which is another way you can become infected with this parasite. So, for example, in France, where eating undercooked meat is a delicacy, there tends to be more Toxoplasma gondii people infected. There doesn't tend to be more schizophrenia, so we can't relate that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're asking a good question that we can't answer yet.
Mm-hmm. And when it's been 50 years now that we've been telling pregnant women don't clean the litter box. Should there even be a litter box in the house? Should you maybe put the cat somewhere else during that 9-month period?
No, I think it's safe if the litter box is changed every 24 hours.
Okay.
Then it does not have a chance to become aerosolized and should be safe. If the pregnant woman is not changing the litter box, and if the litter is changed every 24 hours, it should be safe.
Ann in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome, Ann.
Hi. Real quick question. I assume that there are researchers who are working on a method of prevention, a cure for this, for the cats.
The answer is yes, there is some work going on a vaccine. That would be the simple answer, is to be able to vaccinate. But, you know, until recently, people have not really considered this to be much of a problem. So there's been relatively little research going on. That's one of the reasons why we published the paper that we did 2 weeks ago, is to try and bring more attention to this and to elicit more research interest in it.
Yeah, because usually we go for things that are going to, we try to inoculate or to keep the cats from getting sick. We don't think of it in terms of us getting sick, but not the cat.
But if you could vaccinate our kittens, say, before uh-huh. they become infected, you could prevent this disease altogether.
I would think that would be certainly a way to go.
Mm-hmm. It is a way to go, absolutely.
Okay. Thank
Anne,
you.
Thanks a lot. Since cats have been living with these oocysts for millions of years, does that in any way affect the ability to inoculate against them or prevent the spread? Does it make it more difficult?
I don't understand the question, Anne.
Well, if the cats live with them and they've been
yep.
living with them for millions of years,
yep.
For the people who are researching how to fight them, does that make it more difficult? The cats are welcome hosts.
Well, like most infectious agents, they develop hosts. You know, we're hosts to many different kinds
right.
of bacteria and viruses. This is just an example of a parasite that the cat has become a host to. And what happens is over a period of time, usually hundreds of thousands or millions of years, the host then accommodates with the visitor, in this case, the Toxoplasma gondii. So the fact that the cat doesn't get sick does make it more difficult because we don't quite know what we're dealing with.
Can humans get tested for it?
Yes, humans can get tested for it. I'm positive for Toxoplasma gondii. About 15% of us are in the United States, and it becomes more common as we get older. And we could get it. I could have gotten it when I was playing in the sandbox when I was 4 years old. I might have gotten it when I ate some undercooked meat. You could get it a number of ways, and for most of us, it doesn't seem to be doing anything.
Also, it's not clear that if these impacts of the oocysts, say it's implicated in schizophrenia, learning disabilities, and those kinds of things, it could take years to occur.
It could indeed, and that's true of most diseases
okay.
of the brain, multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, whatever causes these diseases, we now strongly suspect gets in the brain several years before you start to see the symptoms on it. So this idea of something getting in the brain and then remaining quiet, remaining latent for long periods of time, we consider that probably happens quite commonly.
When you talk about cleaning the litter box every 24 hours, you're talking about dumping out everything in the litter box and cleaning it.
Well,
or are you talking about the usual sifting thing that goes on?
I don't have a cat myself.
Okay.
What I'm guessing is you're dealing with getting rid of any of the cat feces in there.
Okay.
So that you wouldn't have to, the urine is not a problem.
Okay.
It's the feces that's a problem.
All right. All right, Dr. Fuller-Torrey, thanks for joining us today. It was very interesting.
You're quite welcome, Anne.
Dr. Fuller-Torrey is a psychiatric research scientist who specializes in schizophrenia and bipolar disorder at the Stanley Medical Research Center, where he is executive director. We'll continue with Wellness Wednesday after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Wednesday night on WOSU-TV, explore the incredible career of an American hero born in Ohio who put country before self on John Glenn, A Life of Service. Through interviews with historians, journalists, and lawmakers, learn about his career spanning seven decades, from war pilot to the first American to orbit the Earth to his days in the U.S. Senate. Watch the premiere of John Glenn, A Life of Service, Wednesday night at 9 on WOSU-TV.
Support comes from On the Square Yoga, offering 45-minute midday yoga classes at 11, noon, and 1 in downtown Columbus. On the Square Yoga, located at 65 East State Street between the Ohio Theater and the Sheraton, making yoga accessible to everybody. More at onthesquareyoga.com.
89.7 NPR News is your all-day NPR news station, bringing you news and information 7 days a week and always streaming at WOSU.org.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Every day, thousands of scientists help invent new drugs intended to cure or treat an illness. And finding the right medicines involves a lot of trials and a lot of errors. But when a drug doesn't work on one disease, that isn't necessarily the end of its story. Or so went the thinking into a new grant program from the National Institutes of Health, which asked researchers to take drugs that have had disappointing therapeutic results in one disease and investigate their use in others. A Yale research team was one of the awardees in this case. They were asked to take a drug intended to treat cancer and apply it to Alzheimer's disease. Joining us now to talk about that process is Dr. Stephen Stripmatter, a professor of neurology and neurobiology at Yale. Dr. Stripmatter joins us by phone from New Haven. Welcome to the show, Dr. Stripmatter.
My pleasure to be here and to talk to you.
How did you apply for the grant did you do it by proposing the possible other use for the drug?
That's right. Well, we had been studying Alzheimer's here at Yale, and through that process, we came to a particular molecule, a particular gene as being important. That's called FYN, F-Y-N. And then the NIH came out with this program, and we, looking down the list of drugs, there was a drug on their list which attacked the same protein that we had discovered as being implicated in Alzheimer's disease. So we sort of came from Alzheimer's and looked at their list. We didn't take the list and look for an application.
The name of the drug is AstraZeneca. What was it originally intended for?
Right. The company is called AstraZeneca.
Oh, okay.
And the drug has just a number.
Okay.
0530. They had developed it for treatment of cancer, and the reason being that this group of proteins that we'd implicated in Alzheimer's disease from our studies had been implicated in the ability of cancer cells to crawl around, that is, to metastasize, move from one place to another. And so they were testing it in that kind of condition.
What gave you the idea that it might work on Alzheimer's? I mean, you said it's the molecule, they're going after the same molecule, FYN.
Right. So we were approaching Alzheimer's without thinking about this particular protein or this drug, but you may have heard about the peptide called amyloid beta, one of the key triggers for Alzheimer's disease. We were interested in how amyloid beta make synapses in the brain malfunction.
Mm-hmm.
So we doing the things that molecular biochemists and neuroscientists do to try to figure out the mechanism. We found that A beta binds to the neuron, binds to one protein, and then triggers a process inside the neuron that makes these synapses between neurons malfunction. And for that to happen, this particular kinase called FYN was necessary. It was part of the pathway that goes awry downstream of amyloid beta. And that's why interrupting it would be beneficial, we believe, that's our hypothesis, for Alzheimer's disease.
Is amyloid beta the stuff that they call, like, the plaque?
That's right. Amyloid beta is the name for the peptide, and then when it piles up in big clumps, mm-hmm. those clumps are called plaque. Exactly.
My guest is Dr. Stephen Stripmatter. He's a professor of neurology and neurobiology at Yale, and we're talking about research that a team of his at Yale has been working on using one drug that didn't work for what it was prepared for what it was created for, which was a treatment of cancer, but is being studied now as a treatment for Alzheimer's disease. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Stripmatter, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Stripmatter, have you ever looked at other drugs in this way before?
We haven't sort of done this repurposing, as it's called,
okay.
by the NIH. But I would say, though, that this is a really quite dramatic opportunity. We've been studying this pathway in the Alzheimer's brain, and we found step one, and then we found step two, and then we came to step three, which is this FYN. Each of these steps are potential drug targets, But once we find a protein, to go from a discovery of a gene in a protein to searching for drugs, optimizing drugs, and eventually getting something that you could test in a person at all is a decade or more long process. When we got to step three, there was this drug that AstraZeneca had already developed that targets this particular protein called FIN very well. And so we sort of leaped over 10 years of work that we would otherwise have to do to go from discovery to an actual clinical trial. And it's the NIH's program and this serendipity of linking this Alzheimer's step number three in this pathway to an existing drug that allows us to greatly accelerate the pace of research from laboratory discovery to clinical trial.
Now, what is your relationship then with AstraZeneca, the maker of 0530, this treatment we're talking about?
Cordial? No, that's a joke.
Well, no, that's okay. I just wonder, do you have a relationship? Are they part of this?
Right. So the NIH worked on this prior to any involvement. So for this list of, it was, I think, about 50 drugs that the NIH put on this list, they had already reached out to multiple drug companies and said, we want to launch this problem. If you can make a drug available, you have to do it under particular terms, mm-hmm. where it will be available to academic researchers, where the NIH will be a partner in developing the drug through the first stages, but certain rights are retained by the company. The NIH had pre-negotiated that, regardless of which academic group might actually use the drug for any new purpose. So Yale piggybacked onto the agreement that the NIH and AstraZeneca had already prearranged.
Oh, okay. And could more than one group have picked 0530 as a potential research topic? They could be looking, seeing something else in it that would be of interest to their research or furthering their efforts?
That's right. This list of 50 drugs was available to basically, you know, all scientists and all clinicians in the world working on every topic. I think, I don't have the exact numbers, but I believe the NIH received some 200 applications. And in the end, they funded 9 of those projects are going forward. And in fact, this same drug is being used by a group in Texas to attempt to treat a lung disorder.
Randy in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Steven Stripmatter. Welcome.
Yes, I have a relative, matter of fact, she's my aunt, and she has Alzheimer's, and she's in really good health, but she just doesn't have her mind, you know, and it's very disappointing. It's like we've already lost her. And my question was, I mean, you're talking about this new drug. How long do you think it will be until this is approved?
Right. So I'm sorry to hear about your aunt. You know, Alzheimer's is a disease that really robs people of the core of their existence when they don't know themselves and their family. The process towards making a drug, certainly this NIH program is creating a shortcut so that we can go from a laboratory discovery into a clinical trial with a drug that's already been proven. Although it may not be too effective for cancer, it's at least safe in humans. So how quickly could things go? The plan that we have to get through the first set of human trials will be about 3 years. And then there would need to, if those things all look promising and successful, there's probably another 2 to 3 years before a drug is FDA approved for Alzheimer's indication. And unfortunately, that sounds like a long time and is very frustrating, I'm sure, to you. But the normal process to start from a discovery to a drug might be more on the average of 10 to 15 years. So this process that the NIH has started may be cutting the timeline in half, which is a very good thing.
This, and Randy, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it. The fin molecule, is this step, is by approaching it in this step, does anything that you do in your involvement with the development of this drug make it less, and the NIH for that matter, make it less costlier down the road? Is that part of the agreement with AstraZeneca?
Less, you mean if it's
make it less,
if all these trials are successful and it actually
hits the market? And
I'm not aware that there's any implication of NIH's agreement on the cost, the eventual marketing of this compound by AstraZeneca.
It'll still be owned by AstraZeneca.
That's correct.
Right. Okay. Once again, 614-292-8513. If you have a call, a question, or comment for my guest, Dr. Steven Stripmatter, are there other drugs, not necessarily failed drugs, out there that are likewise of interest to you, drugs that are developed for other diseases but could apply to Alzheimer's treatment as well?
I guess I would say one, there's a couple trials that I'm not involved in directly, but I'll just let you know about. There was a large Alzheimer's trial with something called IVIG, immunoglobulin. It's used for a number of autoimmune diseases. It was recently tried in a large phase 3 trial. It didn't turn out to be successful, but that's actually repurposing of a drug. There's also interest in the overlap between diabetes and Alzheimer's disease, and interest in using insulin delivered intranasally to people with Alzheimer's. Again, a treatment for diabetes, insulin, being used for Alzheimer's disease. So I think there certainly are overlaps with other drugs, other conditions that might be relevant, and again, might be shortcuts towards this massive problem that we have in trying to figure out a treatment for Alzheimer's disease.
And your interest in the fin molecule, is that part of the progression of Alzheimer's, or is it part of the symptoms of Alzheimer's? And I'm not sure there's a difference between that, but in other words, if it works, would it only be addressing the progression and not necessarily how far the disease has gone that at that point and the damage that it's done at that point?
I think a distinction that's frequently made in the field is between what are called symptomatic therapies and what is called disease-modifying therapy. So symptomatic isn't changing the Alzheimer's disease, but it allows you to think or perform a little bit better for the time that the dose is active, and then you're right back to square one. Disease-modifying either slows down, halts, or even reverses the disease process itself, that is, the loss of synapses, the loss of neurons. Here, with this fin compound, the reason that we're testing it is because it's directly involved in how A-beta triggers this loss of synapses in the brain. So we think it would be disease-modifying if it's successful. It would actually either slow down, halt, or reverse the disease process itself.
How many drugs are out there now for people who have Alzheimer's disease, either symptomatic or the other one? I've forgotten already what I mean. Sorry.
Disease modifiers.
Disease modifiers, yeah.
Right. So I guess we could say there's really two classes of drugs. One are molecules that change acetylcholine levels in the brain. These are considered symptomatic therapies. These are FDA approved. There's a number of them from different drug companies, but they all do generally the same thing. They raise acetylcholine in the brain, and this has a mild symptomatic benefit and very widely used by probably millions of people. The other drug is called Namenda, and it affects another neurotransmitter in the brain. It's approved for treatment of moderate to severe Alzheimer's disease. And I guess you could say there's a little bit of debate whether it's symptomatic or disease-modifying. But its effect is also, although these two drug classes are approved, the benefits while detectable and important, are very far from halting Alzheimer's disease, and we desperately need better treatments.
I always want to be really clear. We've heard about this lately in the news, drugs being used that are successful for or created or developed for one disease or symptom being used for others without approval from the Food and Drug Administration. Is that possible with what you're doing?
So this drug, for this particular compound, AZD0530, it's been tried in an investigational sense for cancer. It's not an approved drug. You can't go out and buy it for cancer.
Okay.
So it wouldn't fall into the category that you're talking about.
Okay.
And this NIH support, this grant and the program we're running at Yale seeks, we filed with the FDA as an investigational new drug, and it's being used specifically in the setting of clinical trials that will define whether it is beneficial or not in a controlled way.
When you do clinical trials, are they done in the United States?
Yes.
Okay.
All of the ones that are part of this program are in the United States.
All right. Well, Dr. Steven Stripmatter, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Steven Stripmatter, he's a professor of neurology and neurobiology at Yale, and he's also in lead of the Yale research team. It was an awardee from the National Institutes of Health to take a look at a drug intended to treat cancer and apply it to Alzheimer's disease. Coming up, we continue with Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Right. On the next Fresh Air, Jason Isbell performs songs from his new album, songs he wrote after getting sober. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Days when we
support comes from the Homeport Noble on Long condominiums, offering homeownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District, featuring green design buildings within walking distance of local stores and restaurants. Details at homeportohio.org/NOBO on Long.
Google Glass, the computer you'd wear like eyeglasses, takes pictures and video. It's not equipped with facial recognition technology, but that's not stopping this hacker.
What I'm building is an alternative operating system that runs on Glass, but is not controlled by Google.
Hacking Google Glass, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 4 till 7 on 89.7 NPR News.
Get 89.7 NPR News anytime, anywhere with the WOSU Public Media mobile app. Go to WOSU.org/mobile app and download today.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Maybe the 1978 Ramones song, I Want to Be Sedated, grates on your last nerve. But for another who loves that song and that music, it might be the key to recovery. New research shows that playing a person's favorite music may actually reduce their need for medical sedatives. Here to talk about the more melodic solution to reducing anxiety is the study's lead author, Dr. Linda Klein, who studies and teaches about medical symptom management at OSU. We welcome you by phone, Dr. Klein. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Your research was conducted on 373 patients in the intensive care units of 5 hospitals around Minneapolis, and you found that those who listened to music had reduced levels of anxiety. How did you pick the music?
Patients that were randomly assigned to the experimental music group actually participated in a music assessment by a board-certified music therapist, one of my research colleagues, and also a co-author on our paper. What Dr. Heiderscheidt did was we developed a checklist that was easy to administer to mechanically ventilated patients who are unable to speak because of the placement of the endotracheal tube.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very simple yes, no. Do you like classical? Do you like piano? Do you like new age? That sort of thing. And then Dr. Heiderscheidt use that baseline information to then develop a personalized collection of either CDs or we loaded them onto an MP3 player. And then each of the music collections was specifically tailored by the music therapist to the patient's own preferences.
I guess the Ramones probably wasn't on that list.
I have to tell you, Anne, I sort of had to chuckle and almost grit my teeth when I heard that song because I was at a conference one time several years ago, and one of the presenters used that music after his presentation, and it just didn't sit well with me.
Because even if you like that kind of music...
Well, I mean, I like the Ramones,
yeah,
but...
Yeah, exactly. It's not what you're talking about,
no,
right?
No, not at all. No, not at all.
How did you measure... first of all, what were you measuring when in this study you did?
Sure. We had several outcomes or aims of the study. Our primary aim of the study was to determine whether or not tailored preferred music, where patients would listen to the music whenever they wanted for as long as they wanted each day they were on the mechanical ventilator in the ICU. And we wanted to know if that patient-directed intervention could reduce anxiety as well as reduce sedative exposure, which we quantified as the frequency that sedatives were administered to patients as well as the intensity of that medication regimen. And then some of our secondary outcomes were length of time on the ventilator, length of ICU stay, and then we also had an exploratory measure where we looked at cortisol in the urine, which is a marker of stress in mechanically ventilated patients.
And what did the study show?
The main findings were that patients who listened to the preferred tailored music experienced less anxiety over the course of the study, as well as receiving less frequent and less intense sedative medications. So we were able to reduce anxiety, which is a very common symptom in mechanically ventilated ICU patients. It's a very distressing environment. You know, the whether or not one is going to live or die is not known. And admission to an ICU is an unplanned event for most patients and their family members. So we know anxiety is a common symptom. And we were able to reduce that anxiety with a non-drug intervention while also in the presence of these patients receiving less sedative medication.
How were the patients, the participants, I guess, in the study, were they able to change the music, you know, whether it was an MP3 player or a
CD
or however you did it?
Yeah, understood. Some patients were able to do that, but many times patients who have lengthy stays in the ICU, their extremities become weak, and they may or may not have their reading glasses with them, so they may or may not be able to have, you know, keen visual acuity to manipulate these players. So what we did for most patients was we played the music continuously. So then all the patient had to do was put the headphones, because we use noise-canceling headphones to deliver the music, all they had to do was put the headphones on and off their head. But in addition to that, we would leave suggestions for the nursing staff. For example, the patient likes X CD before nighttime. or he likes, excuse me, or he likes to listen to Bach in the morning, those types of things. So we did need cooperation from the nursing staff as well to assist the patient with changing the CDs, or a family member as well.
I know that this is impossible for some people to believe, but some people don't listen to music that
often. Exactly.
No,
that's true. That's
true. And I was wondering, when you came across those people, how you helped them decide.
Well, I think some of that patients self-selected out because my research staff would screen all our ICUs daily, and if there was a patient who met our criteria, they would ask the nurse if it was okay if they went in and talked with the patient about the study. And we explained to them that they would be allocated by chance to one of three groups. And if it came up during that brief screening period, there were times when patients would just shake their head no and, you know, mouth to us that they don't listen to music. So some of that, they had self-selected themselves to not even participate in the study.
But they had to be conscious enough to make the choices.
To give consent.
Okay.
Exactly, exactly. That was one of our criteria for being considered in the study. They had to be interacting, and they had to pass the screening criteria that we used for inclusion as well.
What need is there for reducing the amount of medical sedatives? I mean, I think maybe it seems obvious to some people, but
mm-hmm.
but what is the advantage?
Sure. Years ago, we used to think that sleeping through a critical illness, similar to how we anesthetize patients when they have major surgery, we used to think that was a good thing. And by we, I'm saying critical care clinicians.
Mm-hmm.
We used to think that was good, that patients would sleep through their critical illness and not have memories. But we have learned over the last several years that patients want to know what's going on. They want to be aware of their surroundings. They want to interact with their family and loved ones. But we've also found out that patients who don't recall what happened to them, and those are usually the patients that are very critically ill, highly sedated, receiving lots of medications, they can develop psychological symptoms after the ICU, similar to post-traumatic stress disorder, or if they have memories that are not factual because of the sedating medications that they get, can also contribute to psychological problems after patients are out of the ICU. And in addition to the psychological effects of these medications, if patients are sedated, they're not moving around, they're not being able to sit up in the chair, they're not able to participate in mobility interventions, and every day that a patient is on bed rest, they're losing muscle mass and muscle strength. So their recovery can be prolonged even greater, because they're so weak once they recover from their critical illness.
So the longer or the more you can keep them alert and conscious, the better in recovery and all things. On the other hand, and when they're alert and conscious, this is when these anxieties can set
exactly,
in.
Exactly, exactly. So it's a balancing act. It's, we want patients to be comfortable, but we also want them awake, interacting, because now we know that that's a sort of like a protective way to be. But there are some patients that are so ill that they do require a fair amount of sedative medication.
The anxiety-reducing properties of music in adult subjects was one thing, but what about babies? Joining us now is Alejandra Ferrer. She's a music therapist at the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Welcome to the show, Dr. Ferrer.
Thank you very much.
The fact that you work in the NICU with babies who haven't had a chance to develop personal musical preferences suggests that music itself has healing properties, right?
Yes, that's correct.
What do we know about the research on that?
Well, we know that when a person listens to music, preferably if they've, you know, if they're an adult or they've had experiences with music, we know that when they listen to music that they find enjoyable, their brain responds through pleasurable responses. So there is a release of pleasurable chemicals by the brain when a person comes in contact with music that they enjoy. Their familiarity with music also has an influence on this, the history that they have with the music. If the music is culturally relevant to their life, to their experiences, they will also develop, respond in a positive manner. With babies, we know that from the time that babies are born, they're already born with musical preferences. They are familiar during that third trimester of pregnancy. They hear everything that the mom is hearing, and they're able to respond to music that they heard when they were in the womb. With babies at Nationwide Children's Hospital, we use a lot of traditional lullabies, which are very soothing and very calming and help to relax them enough so that they continue that neurological development that is so important and is really impeded by coming into this world much earlier than they were supposed to.
Being stuck in a hospital.
Exactly, definitely. And being stuck in a hospital. We're also doing a research study right now where we are looking at the effect of the parents' voices. So mom's voice and dad's voice. We're having the parents record themselves singing songs, reading stories, saying prayers, having conversations with the baby. And we play these recordings for the babies multiple times during the day. And we believe through research that already exists that this will have a positive effect on their development, and in turn, they will be able to leave the hospital sooner.
I don't know what a neonatal intensive care unit looks like, but does it turn into like a unit of babble? I mean, or are you selectively doing this with certain babies in isolated situations?
Yes. We're currently working with babies who are 28 weeks gestational or older, and these babies are inside isolettes. And so each baby has their own iPod and a set of speakers, so only he or
already.
She can hear the music. Yes.
Dr. Klein, how much of what Dr. Ferrer was talking about earlier as far as understanding the impact of music on the pleasure centers of the brain, how much did that inform what you do?
Oh, it informs quite a bit, which is why we do the music assessment of patients' preferences, because we know if a piece of music is familiar and comforting to patients, that will reduce their anxiety.
Dr. Ferrer, what types of illnesses do you treat with music in the NICU?
Primarily, the work that I'm doing is with babies diagnosed with bronchopulmonary dysplasia. That's a chronic lung disease. Because of the chronic lung disease and their long-term hospitalization, there's also a variety of secondary negative effects that occur. So the babies, the great majority of them, are showing significant developmental delays in cognitive, physical, emotional, and social areas. So that's something that we're targeting with music. Music therapists in the neonatal intensive care unit are working a lot, again, to enhance relaxation, to decrease stress and anxiety in the babies.
The same thing as they're talking about with Dr. Klein's work.
Exactly, exactly. We know that hospitalization is very traumatic, regardless of the age that the stage of life that you mm-hmm. find yourselves in. We're also using music to really help the babies organize their behavior. They're very, very disorganized when they're born prematurely. They have a difficult time collecting themselves because they're simply not ready to be in this environment yet. And then also with the older infants, many of the babies that are in the NICU, they stay there for 5 months, 6 months. We've had babies that are over 2 years of age when they're finally discharged from the NICU. We're also using music therapy to augment the goals that physical, speech, and occupational therapy are working on.
Does the ailment dictate the music or whether music's used at all? You mentioned the bronchial, I guess it's a breathing disorder of some sort, right?
Yeah. And we know through the research that soothing, calming music, which we use with our youngest babies, it does have a direct effect on increasing oxygen saturation levels, on regulating respiration rate, on decreasing heart rate. So if we're using music to pacify and to calm a baby down, then we're certainly going to select music that is of a slower tempo, you know, very simple melodic contours. And, you know, right now, all of the music that we use, aside from the research study that I was speaking about, is live. So I'm delivering the music intervention. The other music therapists who work at Nationwide Children's Hospital are delivering the intervention live. So we're singing, playing our guitars, using auxiliary percussion instruments.
Dr. Klein, I mean, it's not a coincidence in a way that what you're doing is you're talking about people who are on respiratory.
Right, ventilatory support.
Mm-hmm. Right, and again, that the whole idea of breathing, if you're not relatively relaxed when you're mm-hmm. doing it, you're not getting what you need out
of it. Exactly. And that also is one of the reasons why mechanically ventilated adults receive sedative medication, is so the mechanical ventilator can deliver the oxygen gas to the patient. And if the patient's very anxious or fighting those mechanical breaths, because it can be a very unnatural thing for some patients. I always tell people, if you've ever snorkeled or scuba dived, you know what it's like. You have to relax to breathe through one of those breathing apparatuses. And mechanical ventilation is very similar to that.
Is mechanical ventilation used with some of the patients that you're talking about, Dr. Ferrer?
Yes. Our patients, because of their BPD diagnosis, they're either on a ventilator similar to Dr. Klein's patients, or they are a nasal cannula, so still receiving, you know, the oxygen, or on a CPAP machine similar to what, you know, adults who have some sleep apnea use at night.
As children get older, you know, we joked just a minute ago about they're getting their first iPod and that sort of thing at, you know, and their newborns. A lot of kids have their own iPods at very young ages now. Do you see hospitals encouraging parents to let their kids bring in their iPod or their music, whatever the device they're using?
Yes, certainly. Certainly, you know, especially for those kids who have a chronic illness and therefore are hospitalized for long periods of time, we encourage music as a very powerful coping skill. And so we do. The music therapists who work in the pediatric hospital in the section outside of the NICU. They're helping children write their own songs. They're making CD lists for these kids to listen to.
And I don't know if it applies with what you're doing, Dr. Klein, too, but just that feeling of being able to choose what you want to listen
exactly.
to, that being able to have some kind of control over something.
Yes, exactly. That is why we modeled our experimental intervention to be patient-directed, because we know with patient-controlled analgesia, for example, patients self-administering pain medication, such as after surgery, we know those patients feel an enhanced sense of control, and they're actually more satisfied with their pain management experience. So that's gave me the idea to design my intervention with similar principles in mind, that, you know, we know that anxiety levels vary similar to pain levels vary in patients. So we devised the intervention to have it be when the patient wants it and for how long they would like to listen to the music.
Dr. Linda Klein, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Linda Klein, she's a professor of medical symptom management at OSU. And also Alejandra Ferrer, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
An ICU music therapist at Nationwide Children's Hospital. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus.